Former NPR reporter and host Guy Raz has this incredibly popular podcast. We're talking millions of listeners. And it's about how people who came up with an idea turn it into something big. And I think the reason it has so many followers is because most everyone has an idea or is looking for an idea that could change everything for them. But how do you do it? How do you make it work? And that's what he tries to get at in the podcast and in a new book he's written. Raz says in most of these success stories, there's always this do or die moment where either they're going to break through and make it or just fail. And he tells the story of Gary Hirschberg, who, along with a friend, had started the yogurt company called Stonyfield Farm. And yeah, you've heard about it now, but Raz tells about this moment in the early days of the company when it looked like this one was just not going to happen. But Hirschberg couldn't, or he wouldn't, let it go.
It began because Gary Hirschberg really wanted to make great yogurt. And he believed in this product so much that he couldn't see it failing. Despite the fact that every single year over the first decade of this brand, he lost money. He lost leases on dairy farms. Other dairies tried to take over his business. He had to beg investors to continue to support him. It got to the point where he and his business partner, Samuel Kamen, are almost at the end of their rope and very close to insolvency. Late one night, they're driving back to Vermont, where they're based, and they stop the car on the side of the road, and Gary looks at Sam, his partner, and he says, "Wait a minute. What if we stop renting out yogurt facilities? What if we build our own facility and cover our capacity? Could we do that?" And miraculously, they figured out a way to find the money through small business loans to build their own facility. They still had another 2 years of financial collapse and losses. But by 1991, they turned a corner and started to see a profit and went on to produce one of the most successful yogurt brands in history. When you fundamentally believe that the world needs what you make and that there is no turning back and that if you can't succeed, nobody will, it's like this force that helps keep you going.
Is there always a time in the process when the people who've talked to you say when they think they have to quit? Does that seem like the thing that happens time and time again?
In every business, there are moments where you want to quit. And I would argue that it's actually fundamental to the process because you can't actually figure out how to succeed without experiencing a series of failures and setbacks. Those are what help you understand and learn. That's actually how we build resilience. When you experience failure and setbacks time and again in small and sometimes less small ways, it inoculates you to be able to withstand the bigger failures. That's why I'm so interested in focusing on failures and using them as lessons to help teach others how to plow forward.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Guy Raz is with us today to talk about his book, How I Built This. And Raz himself seemed to be headed somewhere else before he became a popular podcast host. He was NPR's Berlin bureau chief, the London bureau chief. He reported from Jerusalem, covered the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He was NPR's defense correspondent. He was the host of Weekend All Things Considered. I mean, he did a lot. He was successful. But I asked him, at that point, was his life working out the way he wanted it to?
Success is a very relative term because, you know, on the path to anyone's quote-unquote success is a lot of a lot of failure, struggle, and in my case, a lot of setbacks and anxiety and really deep, dark moments of despair. You know, at that time in my career, I really didn't see a path forward. I had been the weekend host of All Things Considered. I didn't see a path beyond that because my role wasn't part of the plan that news managers at NPR had at the time. And that was a tough time for me because it was a realization that I would not be the main host or anchor of an NPR program, and that really I had to kind of figure something else out. But that failure was crucial and fundamental for me, as failures are for most people, in that it was a kick in the rear end. It forced me to reevaluate what I wanted to do with my life and my career and stop allowing other people to determine my path for me. And that was just a huge realization for me. It really enabled me to think very differently about what I wanted to do. And I left the news world and I went into this odd world called podcasting. And I began to create shows that were not about the news, that were not even listened to on the radio, and that were kind of a backwater, you know, in 2012.
Yeah.
But that really, of course, fundamentally changed my life and enabled me to kind of pivot into a new direction, a new career. And so I really reflect on my failures. And one of the reasons why I put this book out is because I believe that all of us, every single person, acts and thinks entrepreneurially without even realizing it. And essentially, entrepreneurial thinking is a mindset, right? It is not it's not like a gift that you're born with or this thing that some people have and some people don't. It's a mindset. And for me, over the course of my career, I began to connect the dots to realize that I was acting and behaving entrepreneurially, but now I really needed to kind of reflect on it and use it to be entrepreneurial, to actually be an entrepreneur. And so that's where the idea for this book really came, to kind of show people how they are already acting entrepreneurially and how to kind of turn that into an entrepreneurial enterprise or action or service or idea or product or whatever it might be, whether you build it on your own or you're building it within the organization where you work.
In a New York Times article a few years ago, you said that you don't consider yourself a reporter anymore. And so I'm wondering how you approach the conversation, the interviews, even the editorial process with the shows that you're working on now, the show that you work on now. What part of it that you do now is not what a reporter does? I mean, it seems like you're bound by the same kinds of things. Or do you feel released from some sense of objectivity maybe, and maybe you can express yourself in ways that you couldn't before, didn't feel like you could before?
Well, I would sort of make the analogy that, like, Oprah was a reporter at one time in her career. Yes. You know, she was a news reporter. And I don't think anybody would consider Oprah to be a reporter today. But I think that her interviews and her conversations are some of the most powerful and revealing conversations, full stop. I think she's one of the best interviewers operating in the English language. So, you know, I don't sort of see it's not that I differentiate one or the other. I focus more on illuminating human stories. Yeah. You know, my job is to get inside someone's head and go along on a journey with them. We are all living in our own movie. That's our consciousness. What we see through our eyes is our own experience and our own story. And what I try to do in the show and in this book is to bring all of us inside that movie, that this person's movie, whether it's, you know, whether it's Richard Branson or Howard Schultz or, you know, Lisa Price, who founded Carol's Daughter, or you know, David Neeleman, who founded JetBlue, any of these entrepreneurs. My job is to get into their movie. So we are in the cockpit in their brain, and we can experience their lives contextually and understand the decisions they made, the mistakes they made, and the path they took. And that's really fundamental to helping us understand our own journeys. When we can begin to relate to other people's journeys, and the stories that they tell, especially people we admire, it can really inspire us to change things about our own lives.
You write about making this, I don't know if it was exactly an epiphany, but this kind of discovery when you were doing this Nieman journalism fellowship at Harvard, like I think it was 12 years ago, and you started to see something in these stories. What was it that you were noticing about them?
I realized that the stories of entrepreneurs are essentially heroes' journeys. And if you're familiar with Joseph Campbell, then you know what I'm talking about. Joseph Campbell wrote about this concept many, many decades ago, which was that in the great epics like Gilgamesh or the Odyssey and, of course, Star Wars eventually and Harry Potter and others, there are similar narrative arcs. You know, there are similar moments that a hero experiences. They fall into an abyss. They battle a dragon. They find a mentor. They have a near-death experience. It's a crucible. There are metaphorical similarities between people who found businesses and the journeys they take and the people, you know, talked about in these hero's journeys. I mean, you know, in Utah, I mean, the story of Davis Smith and Cotopaxi is a hero's journey. I mean, he, you know, he really went through a whole series of challenges and ups and downs and losses and failures and triumphs. And then eventually started Cotopaxi, which is a really cool, brand, and you know is now in the midst of his own, you know, I think his own challenges with the pandemic and trying to keep his business going and moving forward. So those experiences really are connected in my mind to the drama of the human experience, mm-hmm. and that's I mean how I built this. The book and the show, they are business books and they're designed to help people think about their businesses or about, you know, about the way they work. But they're really human journeys told through the prism of business. Mm. And I think that's actually much more useful and helpful for people when they're thinking about how to structure their work lives. It's we learn from stories much more so than we do from abstract ideas.
Yeah. And it seems like that's why the show works. That's why it's so successful is because it seems like you have to overcome this impulse that a lot of people may share being suspicious of rich and successful people because sometimes, you know, you imagine them as being out of touch or really eccentric. But it seems like you're more interested in the moments maybe before they got to that point when they were really rich. I mean, it's the process that they get to. Before that, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's important because we all have to remember that Howard Schultz or David Neeleman of JetBlue or, you know, or JW Marriott. I mean, these people, there was a time in their lives where nobody would take their phone calls, where they were just like you and me. And that's where I'm going because I want people to understand that these are not superheroes. These are people who are just like you and me. The only difference is that they went into the phone booth and put on a cape, you know, and then believed they could fly. It's these tiny, tiny, small shifts in behavior and in outlook that enabled them to achieve these really incredible things. Things that I think, you know, most of us have the capacity to achieve in some way or another. It doesn't mean we all have to start the next Airbnb, but it means that we all have the capacity to think and act creatively and put ideas out into the world that might have an impact on, you know, on our communities or, you know, on the people around us.
Hmm. How do you select them? I think I read somewhere where you said that you figured you wanted to only talk to people you liked or thought you would like, I guess.
That's sort of true, but I think that the way we look for people on the show and in the book is, do they represent the best of entrepreneurship? Hmm. Do they act with integrity? Are they kind? Do they treat their employees well? Do they behave in a kind manner and fashion? And I have to say, of the 300 people that I've interviewed for How I Built This, you know, I would say more than 95% of them, you can say yes. The answer is yes. Of course, like anybody, you know, sometimes things fall through the cracks. But we really do a lot of research and look really hard at the backgrounds of the people that we're interested in interviewing long before we approach them. Mm.
You always ask, you say at the end of an interview, this question: to what extent do they feel luck played a part in their success? And we'll talk about luck in a moment, but what interests me about that question is how it fits in the way you think about the interview itself. You seem to be interested in how they attempt to answer the question, you say. So what is it about that question you think that elicits what you're looking for, getting them to reveal something about themselves?
Yeah, I mean, there's no right or wrong answer to the question because it's not a binary question. Not you know, there's no, well, it was all luck or it was all skill and intelligence that got me to where I am. It's really designed as an opportunity for that person to reflect, because by that point, I've interviewed them for 3, 4, sometimes 5 hours. And it's an opportunity for the person to kind of reflect on the conversation we've just had, which is an examination of their life in a very granular way. And most of us don't get the opportunity to do that. And this is a moment for them to kind of just take stock and reflect on what they've just experienced, and to maybe reassess their own perception of why they are successful. And so it's really designed to kind of give them a chance to do that. I mean, there's no right or wrong answer to that question, but it's an opportunity for them to, I hope, really reveal as close to a real version, and maybe the real version, of who they are.
Yeah. I guess all of the interviews you do, or most of the interviews, have similar kinds of elements. I mean, there's also something specific to the person's experience itself. But I'm wondering, do you create a kind of arc in the conversation? Are you looking for turning point moments? I mean, do they follow a kind of pattern?
I'm always looking for moments of challenge and crisis and failure. I mean, that's really what I'm looking for, and what we try and seek out before we approach somebody. Because a story without a struggle is not – I'm not saying it's not inspiring or interesting. I think by and large for most of us, and I'm here to represent my listeners, they get more out of a story that they can relate to.
Yeah.
And a story of somebody who just – you know, let's say was born with a lot of wealth and just put all that wealth into their business and then succeeded, is less useful and instructive for my audience. You know, there are shows that are certainly out there where that person or people could tell their stories. That's just not what we do on our show.
Yeah.
You know, we look for people who had some struggle and had to figure out how to get through it.
You mentioned you have rules. Or a rule anyway. Nothing is off limits and everything is on the table. Is that a deal breaker for you? And do you – you must get pushback on that. Like, no, I don't want to go here and I'd rather not go here. And how does that work?
It's really simple. We don't force anybody to come on the show.
Yeah.
And we don't beg anybody to come on the show. I mean, we have an audience of 3.5 million people every week. And so people, as you can imagine, want to be on the show. When we get pitched about 1,000 people a week. And we can only do 45 episodes a year. And so our conditions are very simple. We can't accept conditions. We have to be able to ask everything about that person's life, except for private things that
sure.
are completely unrelated to the business. So, you know, I'm not going to ask about their love life or anything. But it's crucial that we don't have any restrictions. And there have been people in the past who've approached us and said, we want to go on the show. We want to talk about this. We want to talk about that. And our answer, we very politely say, thank you for approaching us. We'd love to interview you when you're ready to talk about everything. Come back and let us know.
Guy Raz, his new book is How I Built This: The Unexpected Paths to Success from the World's Most Inspiring Entrepreneurs. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
– KUER is always at your side with level-headed breakdowns of fast-moving headlines. That's why we're right there on your smart speaker. Once you've set your alarms and made that online buy, wind down with NPR Utah by telling your smart speaker to play KUER. It's not two-day shipping. In fact, it's more than that. With immediate journalism you can trust day after day after day. Easy. Just tell your smart speaker to play KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Guy Raz is our guest today, former host of NPR's Weekend All Things Considered, host of the TED Radio Hour. We're talking about his new book, taken from the conversations in his podcast, How I Built This. It's about how innovators and idealists who started and built successful businesses or movements go through something like a hero's journey to make it. There's this position that a lot of people found themselves in early in this process of trying to create something that you write about. And in a lot of the cases, they have a safe job and it's a decent job. You know, they're dreaming of something else, but you say there's this – this is how you put it in the book. You say there's this gap between the familiar part of their life, you know, the regular paycheck, and being out there without a safety net. Talk a little bit about the position that they're in and what you learned about that.
Well, look, for most people, right, when you have a job that is safe, that is, you know, where you've got benefits and so on, it becomes very easy to keep that job and to stay comfortable. And sometimes it becomes crucial because it's, you know, you rely on that, on the benefits, on the healthcare and other things behind it. But, you know, sometimes it's more dangerous to keep that job than it is to leave, because if you find yourself in a position, you know, 20, 30, 40 years later, regretting not having tried to do something that you really want to do, that's dangerous. That's a dangerous place to be. But if you leave that job to go and seek something out, it's scary, right? And so the question is, where is your risk tolerance? Is your risk tolerance for doing something scary or something dangerous? And I think for the most part, most of us would, if we could contextualize it and understand it that way, would probably pick scary. Would probably say, you know what, it is scary to take a leap, but it would be dangerous if I didn't take that leap. And I think that's the calculation that many entrepreneurs take when they decide to, you know, to go for it and to try something new.
This is Jim Koch's experience.
Exactly.
Creator of Samuel Adams, the beer company. And it's an interesting story. I wanted you to say something about it, because it seems like for Jim, as you write about it in the book, he already had this propensity to do something different, to look at a larger picture. He drops out of college, I mean out of Harvard. He's in his 20s, and he spends 3 years basically living his life outdoors. It seems like he already had something there that made him look at the larger picture. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, he had the experience, and I talk about this in the book, of going on Outward Bound trips.
Yeah.
And he knew that, you know, when he was he loved rock climbing. And when he would climb up a cliff, sometimes it was scary because you'd look down and you'd see the ground way down below. But it wasn't dangerous because he was always attached to ropes. Whereas other times he would, you know, take a hike, you know, in early spring when the snows were melting. Mm-hmm. And it seemed perfectly safe. It didn't seem scary at all because it wasn't a steep hill, but it was probably quite dangerous because at any moment that snow and ice could have triggered an avalanche. And so he really reflected on those two experiences, and that really helped him make the decision to leave his safe job at Boston Consulting Group in his mid-30s. He had two kids. He was married. He had a mortgage to start the Boston Beer Company, which really revolutionized the craft beer industry in the U.S.
Yeah, and you say that for Jim, it wasn't leaving that comfortable job that carried the risk. It was staying.
Exactly. Exactly.
You say every business has a story. What do you mean by that?
I think every business is a story. You know, and it doesn't matter whether it's Airbnb or, you know, or Ring doorbells or, you know, JetBlue or an HVAC company in Salt Lake City. There's a reason why somebody started that business. You know, it's very likely that they saw an opportunity because there was a problem that needed to be solved. And maybe the problem was the other HVAC companies in town weren't providing a good service or were too expensive or whatever it might be. And so you created your business to solve that problem. And there's a story behind it. And the story connects you and the people who work with you to the mission of why you do what you do. And that is actually one of the most powerful tools any business owner has in connecting what they do and why they do it with the people that they're trying to serve. And it gives them a reason to use your product or service. And that's why we emphasize storytelling so much in the book and on the show.
But why does that matter? Why does it matter if I want a good lotion for my dry skin? How am I connecting to the origin story of the company that made this product?
Yeah. So one of the things that I do in the book and what it's designed to do is to help people really understand how to tell their story and why that's so important. I mean, think about a product that you use every day that you love, right? Think about here's a good example. Think about a product like Tesla, right? What is it about that product that enables Tesla to actually spend relatively small amounts of money on marketing compared to other automakers? There's a story we know about Tesla. We know why it exists. Tesla owners talk about that product. They are the marketers. They are the force multipliers. And Tesla doesn't spend any money doing that because their story is so clear and understandable and relatable. It's similar with, you know, any product or service that you are committed to. You know, the story and how you tell your story, and I'm not talking about making something up. I'm talking about the fundamental reason for why you do what you do, whether it's Tesla or Kodiak Cakes. You know, Joel Clark, who's a Utah-based entrepreneur, created this brand because he wanted to create a whole grain alternative for breakfast. And he wanted to create a really healthy product that was delicious and nutritious. And that was his mission. And he believed in that. And it started out, you know, when he started selling this with his mom door to door when he was a kid.
Yeah.
So but there are reasons why people, you know, the story can be an important fundamental reason why somebody wants to consume your product or service and support you. And so what I try to do in the book is to help people think about how to build and frame their stories.
You mentioned that this getting your story straight, as you put it in the book, includes the logo, it includes everything, the name. And one of the things you say is that when you ask people about the name of the company, it almost always triggers some kind of response or some kind of story.
You know, the name of a company is such an interesting part of a brand. And for anyone listening who's a business owner, you know, design is absolutely fundamental and crucial to creating a successful business and brand. So name is more of an avatar for the idea of design. You know, think about SoulCycle, for example. SoulCycle is a spinning brand. It's a company that has spin classes. And a hugely successful company that has legions of devotees. The founders of that company spend a lot of time thinking about not only the name, but the details like the colors, the gray and the white and the yellow, the logo, which was designed to look sort of like the spoke of a bicycle, but in an artful way, how they design the interior of the stores. Think about Jenny's Splendid Ice Creams. I know they don't have them in Salt Lake, but if you've been to one in other parts of the country, you know, it's not just that the ice cream is great. It's that the store is designed in such a way that it draws you in. It looks like a pharmacy, but it's not cold. It's very warm and inviting, but also very clean and sparkling. Even the name Jenny's Splendid Ice Cream makes you think differently about that product than if it were just called Jenny's Ice Creams. And so these are all really fundamental parts of building a business, and something that I really talk about in the book and deliberately talk about in the book, because I want people to learn how to think in a design forward way when they're trying to build a business.
Over the years, you've had a number of conversations with Latter-day Saints, members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. What have you noticed about Mormon entrepreneurs?
I love talking to Mormon entrepreneurs because most of them share a common experience, which is the mission, right? Is going on a mission.
Right.
And essentially, a 19-year-old Mormon kid, a boy or girl, a man or woman, is sent somewhere around the world to knock on thousands of doors a month to try and expose people to the faith, right? And that is a tough job because these kids are knocking on door after door after door, and door after door after door is being slammed in their faces. And they have to be polite and kind and resilient and also self-sufficient. And these kids come back to the U.S. Many of them come back to Utah at age 21 to start college. They are in a much better position to take on the world than their counterparts who are also 21 who have not had a similar experience. Now, by the way, it doesn't have to be a mission. It can be the Peace Corps or the military or some other experience where you are exposed to adversity. But there's something very interesting about the mission experience, which is it essentially exposes you to extreme rejection. You can't not come out of that situation, out of that experience, more resilient to rejection. You come out of that experience having grown a second skin. And I think it's not coincidental why there is a relatively high proportion of Mormon entrepreneurs in America. I don't have the scientific data to back up the connection between the mission experience and entrepreneurship, but I think it's kind of self-evident. You know, when you are essentially selling something, an idea in this case, and you're hearing a lot of no's, it helps you understand that eventually you will get some wins, you will get some yeses, and that's okay. It's okay to hear 100 no's if you can get one yes.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the reasons why I really am fascinated with the experiences that many Mormon entrepreneurs have had and why we've had so many on the show.
You know, so there's adversity that makes sense. And I wonder also, do you think in some ways, and I wonder if this is a common trait among successful entrepreneurs, is that it's not just about the business. There's something idealistic, some larger view, you know, some larger sense of faith or spirituality, not necessarily religious, but some larger sense of the world going on there.
You know, I think that fundamentally building a business is about solving problems, right? And in the book, I a lot of people ask me, how do I come up with an idea? And so one of the things I try to do in the book is to help people think about how to ideate, how to come up with an idea. And fundamentally what it's about is identifying a problem that you can solve, not just for yourself, but for other people, a problem that you know lots of other people have. And embedded in that very approach is a sense of idealism. If you are looking to solve a problem, there is an idealistic aspect to it. And so I think that you know, while not every business person or entrepreneur is idealistic maybe in the way that you or I might define it, I do think that there is an idealism embedded in the concept of introducing an idea into the world, right? Because it requires bold. It requires a boldness, and it requires courage, and it requires a belief that it can work. And so that is fundamentally idealistic.
talk a little bit about how and this, I guess this surprised me in some way. I didn't realize, for example, Allbirds, those really popular shoes, they were something completely different at the beginning. They weren't made of wool. They were made of canvas. The idea changed and changed. And it seems to represent something really important about this process, because you say that the ones who seem to make it don't get paralyzed by perfection and are willing to take criticism and be open to change, I guess.
Exactly. I mean, you know, part of putting out a product or service into the world is knowing that it's going to change, that you will at some point maybe dramatically pivot from where you originally started. And that's actually a crucial part of building a successful brand or a company. I mean, you know, I talk about this in the book a little bit, which is about Slack.
Yeah.
Slack started out as a gaming company. You know, it was a game. They wanted to create a massive multiplayer online game that failed. But in the process of failing, they had developed this internal messaging system that actually was pretty great, and that became the business. So that was never the intention, right? And it's a really important part of understanding that failure can lead to something much, much bigger, something much more interesting, you know, a much better product. And I want people who are, you know, who are builders, who are dreamers, to really reflect on that and understand that the first thing that you come up with is not going to be the thing that you end up producing or devoting your life to. It may be something totally different, but you have to be open to that possibility.
Do you think, Guy, the podcast or these podcasts that you're thinking about, you're producing now, is this the thing you wanted to build, or do you have something else in mind? The thing that you truly wanted to do as a, you know, as a life's work and as a business.
You know, it's a good question. I mean, I love making programs and content for people who are looking to be inspired. I mean, that is what I do and what actually inspires me. And I receive messages from people every single day who listen to the show, who are now reading the book, who have said, look, you know, this is like a shot in the arm. I was going through a really tough time with my business or an idea I had, and hearing this story or reading about this person really reminded me that there is possibility out there. And I think we're living in a really challenging moment right now, where a lot of people have anxiety about the future, about the world. And if I can provide material, information, and stories that inspire people, then that's pretty great. That's pretty great. I'm pretty happy doing that.
Guy Raz, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Guy Raz, his new book is How I Built This: The Unexpected Paths to Success from the World's Most Inspiring Entrepreneurs. He's also co-creator and host of the NPR shows How I Built This and the TED Radio Hour. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Ivana Martinez, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.